Google is a household word, both for the online search engine and for the company that created it. And it gets a lot of attention for the ways it finds talented employees and allows them to use their skills in creative and profitable ways. Lots of other companies have tried to capture the secrets of Google's management style and culture in the hopes of replicating the company's success. Our next guest has an inside view, and he joins us to share some of Google's work rules, things like don't trust your gut, taking power away from managers, and why the worst employees can be the secret to success. Laszlo Bock joins us now. He's head of the people function at Google and author of Work Rules, insights from inside Google that will transform how you live and lead. Laszlo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rob, Veronica, thanks for having me, and thanks, if I can say, for the important work you do on public radio. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, now, before we get to your specific work rules, it seems like there's more of a mindset or culture that it's at the root of this. Companies talk about putting people first. A lot of them pay lip service to it. How do you get that putting people first mindset to really take root?
Well, it's a really fundamental thing, actually. Every company says, as you say, people are our most important asset, people matter to us, but they don't treat people that way. And fundamentally, you have to ask yourself, as a person, as a manager, as a leader, do you actually believe people are good, or are they not good? And if you believe they're good, you're going to treat them a certain way and give them more opportunity and freedom.
And you had an experience at an older job, not at Google, where you asked a boss for advice, and he answered something like, yeah, you're basically just an interchangeable cog in our machine here?
Yeah, it was a pretty depressing day. I was pretty new at the company and was asking about, you know, what does it take to get ahead? What can I do? And he basically said, at your level, you're all the same. And he literally said, you're replaceable cogs. And that, he thought, was helpful coaching, but it was kind of the worst thing he could tell me at the time.
So we used the word unique a minute ago to describe the work culture at Google. But do you think other workplaces can port some of these lessons from Google into their own situations?
Absolutely. You know, the thing I was most surprised at was that there's a lot of other companies actually doing very, very similar things, and it's one of the things I try to call attention to. I remember years ago when Google was first named Best Company to Work For, I was put on a panel with the COO of Wegmans. Wegmans is a Northeast grocery chain, and they put us together on a panel because they'd won the prior year and thought we'd have nothing in common. But they're a completely different company, completely different margins, completely different workforce, and we found that we all believe the same things about giving people freedom and opportunity and treating them well.
Well, let's get into some specifics now, and let's start with hiring. What do you try to do to get the best possible talent on board at your company?
Well, the biggest thing is you have to step back and realize that most of us, we think we're fantastic at hiring and assessing people, but the reality is, by definition, we're all kind of average. And the first impressions you make in an interview can be incredibly misleading, and there's great research on that that shows you should not trust your gut when it comes to interviewing. So instead, we have a bunch of people interview candidates. We found that 4 or 5 is the right number. They write up their feedback, and then a separate group, a hiring committee, reviews that feedback. And the hiring committee's only job is to make sure that we're maintaining quality. By taking that power away from sort of the people interviewing and having an independent group do it, you actually make much less biased decisions when you're hiring, and you get a better workforce.
Now, what is the best kind of person to hire? Does it mean, you know, the smartest person or the person who's most skilled in their particular specialty, or what?
That's a trick question. Our biases and the academic research bears this out, that the single biggest thing you should hire for is basically how bright someone is, and not how did they do on an SAT or what were their GPAs. It turns out none of that actually predicts how you will do in life. Instead, you should hire for people who are problem solvers, who can learn, who can figure things out, and there's ways to assess that in an interview. And what works is if you hire for that, then the other stuff tends to sort itself out. Somebody who's bright and curious can learn just about anything. But if somebody doesn't have that innate aptitude and interest in learning, it's going to be really tough turning them into a great performer.
Okay, but how do you measure that then?
So you use what are called structured interview questions. And a structured interview question, it's actually superficially pretty boring stuff. You basically say, if you're hiring for intelligence or for problem solving, you ask the candidate, give me an example of a difficult problem you solved. And you have 3 or 4 interviewers ask the same kind of question, and each one gets a different answer. And then you drill down. What did you do? Why did you do that? How did you approach that? What emerges is that these stories that people will tell you in the interview actually give you a pretty good sense of how they'll perform perform in a real job. So that's what you need to do to sort of identify that.
Now, I've heard legends, and I think you mentioned these in the book, of Google asking really weird, kind of brainy, thinky questions. If you're, you know, the size of a nickel, how do you climb out of a blender or something like that?
Yeah.
What was the point there? Did that work? Do you still do that?
Well, so there's good news and bad news. The good news is we went back and studied it, and we found that those questions don't actually predict how you're going to perform. The problem with those kind of brain teasers and case interview questions is, first of all, it's a coachable skill. So if you practice it, you'll get really good at it. But it doesn't actually have any connection to what you're going to do in a job, because in the real world, none of us ever actually do have to climb out of blenders. So we got rid of them, but the bad news is there's people that we hire all the time, and we hire thousands of people every year, who think these are good questions to ask, and we haven't gotten to them all. So we still ask them once in a while, but we're trying to beat it out of the system.
We're talking to Laszlo Bock from Google, looking at the unique culture at the business and how they create it. We'll continue the conversation in a few and get into the idea of giving less power to managers on the job. You can join the conversation, by the way, at 800-642-1234.
What's the best workplace culture you've ever been a part of? What made it work, and did it make for a more productive workplace? Or what is the worst workplace culture? What went wrong? Do you have a question about how Google operates? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Laszlo Bock. He's head of what Google calls its people function. He shares the internet company's unique way of managing employees in his new book, Work Rules.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Look at the places you've worked, places you've managed maybe. What makes for a good, positive, productive workplace culture? What makes for the opposite? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Cindy on the line with us now in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I work for a company that treats us like we're thieves and liars. And when I first started there many, many years ago, we were empowered. Now we are not allowed to make decisions without our supervisors. This was a company that many years ago people would stay with. If they got in there, they never left, and now the turnover is extremely high. They don't treat us like people. They treat us like numbers.
Cindy, first, I'm sorry for that work experience. And Laszlo, that sounds like kind of the opposite approach to what you're trying to take at Google. You focus on trying to empower people and let them do their thing and use their creativity.
Yeah, I think it's heartbreaking and depressing that and in a way infuriating that there's organizations that treat people that way. I mean, I've had jobs where I was treated that way, and you feel so helpless and powerless, and you look at it and say, why would anybody be doing this? Why would any sane leader do this? And, you know, unfortunately, there's some environments that just don't want to change. Part of the reason behind, you know, putting the book out was we thought maybe we could help more people kind of improve what they do with some of the lessons and some of the things we learned. But sometimes your best option is just to vote with your feet.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cindy, and good luck to you. So one of the ways you try to do that, one of your rules, is to take away managers' power over employees. From a manager's perspective, that doesn't sound like an awesome thing. How does that work?
Well, actually, most managers, when they join Google, are not real happy about that either. What happens is at Google, as a manager, you can't decide who to promote, you can't decide who to hire, you can't unilaterally make a decision about how big a salary increase or bonus somebody gets. And the reason is, as soon as you become a manager, you act differently. When you're an employee, what do you want? You want freedom. You want people to get out of your way. You want maybe a manager to help once in a while. But once you're a manager, you start controlling and managing and telling people what to do. And we want to take as much of that power away from a manager so that the only carrot and stick they have over their employee is the ability to actually help the employee be more successful. And so far, it's worked out okay.
So if the manager doesn't do it, who does?
Well, so we set goals at the company level. One of the things that's kind of neat is Larry Page, our CEO, sets goals for the entire company every 3 months. And everyone in the company sets their goals. But we don't spend a lot of time going back and forth about making sure they're all lined up. Instead, we're transparent with them. So everyone sees Larry's goals, everyone sees mine, everyone sees everyone's. And over a few quarters, everything sort of lines up at that 90, 95% level. So you get a pretty clear sense of what you should be working on and who's aligned and not. And the manager's job isn't, I'm going to force you to do these three things. It's instead, hey, if things aren't working out, kind of what's missing? How can I help you? How can I help you connect?
Let's get back to our callers now. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I find it fascinating what you're talking about, and the other part about it is hiring people not only who know how to solve problems, but also how to identify the problems. I find that a lot of times people or managers don't want to look for a problem to make their life more difficult. They almost want to say, well, this is the way it's always been. And it's usually the people who are able to identify where things are going that are really valuable.
Charlie, thanks for that call. What do you think, Laszlo, trying to identify not just problem solvers, but problem detectors?
Yeah, I think Charlie is spot on. I think one of the most frightening things is when you're in an environment, there's always stuff that's not working right. And it's kind of scary and terrifying to go, you know what, the emperor has no clothes, or, you know, this product isn't as good as it should be, or, you know, it's not ready for market, or, you know, we have too much bureaucracy when it comes to processing expense reports or what have you. And every time someone does that in the real world, you're kind of taking a risk because somebody's whole career is built up around the way that works today. But you got to do it, and that's why the call is so good. You actually need people who are going to be unafraid and say, actually, this needs fixing, and I'm happy to help fix it. Critical, critical thing.
One more rule I wanted to get into. You say some of the best opportunities for a company are among the best employees, and I get that half of it, and among the worst performing employees, and not in the sense of the opportunity to fire the worst employees and get better, but to improve. So why focus on the worst employees?
Yeah, you know, I used to work for GE a long time ago, and GE had this mantra of, you know, the bottom 10%, we're going to identify them, we're going to fire them. And the problem with that kind of approach, and lots of companies have had that approach, GE no longer does, but the problem is you might have two teams which are, you know, one might be way, way better than the other, and by forcing that ranking and getting rid of your bottom people, you're going to hurt the team where all the people are even better. What we instead do is we actually try to figure out what's going on and how can we help that person, because most people actually want to do good work. Most people aren't out to destroy the company. Usually they just need some help. So we try to coach them. When that doesn't work, we coach them, we counsel them to switch jobs, and what we find is 80% of the time when someone switches jobs within the company, their performance goes from bottom of the pack to somewhere around average, which may not sound great, but it's a huge, huge improvement and way cheaper than going out to the market and trying to find someone new.
Well, suppose someone out there is listening as we wrap up. They're a manager. They're an owner of a business. They're thinking, hey, maybe this work environment is an unhappy, unproductive place. What's one thing you would say to jog them into changing their culture?
The biggest, simplest thing anyone can do is just start by asking the people around you, what else should we be doing differently? Because the truth is, I'm not going to have all the answers for everyone on my team. I'm not going to be able to see everything, but the sum of everyone's perspective is going to be way better than anything I by myself can figure out. So just invite them in. Make yourself a little vulnerable and say, what are we not thinking about? What are we missing? Because I promise you, the people working for you, the people on the front lines, the people, you know, cleaning your bathrooms or working with your customers every day, they see all this stuff every day. They know how to make the place better. Just ask them.
Laszlo, thanks for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
That's Laszlo Bock. He's head of people operations at Google and author of the book Work Rules, Insights from Inside Google That Will Transform How You Live and Lead.
The United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case that'll determine whether or not same-sex marriage should be legal in every state in the country. It's one of the biggest cases the court is hearing this term, and plenty of observers were on hand to take it all in.
It's not the first time the court has taken up same-sex marriage. 2 years ago, justices ruled on a pair of cases, including one that challenged California's ban on same-sex marriage. While the court ruled against the ban, it never ruled on whether the ban was constitutional, which takes us up to today.
Eric Citrin joins us now. He's an attorney reporting on today's oral arguments for SCOTUS blog. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So in general, the court is looking at two key questions on same-sex marriage. Can you walk us through them?
Yeah, sure. The first question that the court heard argument today, which is the broader question, was whether or not it is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause or otherwise unconstitutional for states to deny gay and lesbians the right to marry. This you could call the general right to marry question. And then the court was also considering a narrower question, which is whether or not it might be unconstitutional to refuse to recognize same-sex marriages to the extent that those marriages were recognized in another state. So suppose that Jim and Bob get married in New York, where it's legal, and then they move back to Texas, does Texas have a constitutional obligation to at least recognize that out-of-state marriage?
So clearly, if the court says, yes, it is a constitutional right to have same-sex marriage, the answer to question two is not going to matter. But vice versa, could the court rule that states have the right to recognize same-sex marriages performed in states where it's legal, but not require states to allow same-sex marriage as a constitutional right?
That's exactly right. And I think you are correct that it'd be very hard to see how the court could say, yes, there is a right to get married, but no, there's no obligation to honor out-of-state same-sex marriages. It's hard to see your way through to that one. And many observers watching the court today were thus curious as to why they were doing that question second, and also sort of trying to read the tea leaves about which justices didn't seem to care that much about the second question, which would be maybe indicative of how they were going to rule on the first.
And what is the tea leaf reading on that? Is there an indication so far?
Well, it's always very hard to tell from argument, and there's a lot of inferences going on. People also just get tired in the 95th minute of oral argument. But there were people who thought that Justice Kennedy seemed disinterested or less interested in the second question, which might indicate that he was going to go along with a right for same-sex couples to marry in the first question.
And it seems as though Justice Kennedy is the one that people are watching. He seems to be the indicator of which way this case will go. Why is that?
Well, that happens a lot. By natural inclination, Justice Kennedy finds himself in the middle of the court, especially on issues like this one that tend to break sort of on the left-right political spectrum. He just happens to be the middle justice, and his vote, he was one of the five and the most conservative of the five who voted to strike down the federal law refusing to recognize same-sex marriages in the Windsor case 2 years ago. And so you've got him as the most likely swing justice, both generally and in these cases in particular. And so he's the one that everybody is usually watching. And so there was a lot of attention paid to both questions he didn't ask in the second argument and questions he did ask in the first argument to both sides. You know, he had very strong questions for both sides. To the petitioners, those who are advocating for same-sex marriage, he asked a set of questions about whether they should be worried about changing an institution that had been the same for millennia. I think he said he had a word on his mind today, and that word was millennia. And then to the opponents of same-sex marriage, he asked very probing questions about whether, you know, it denies the equal dignity of homosexual citizens and the children that they raise in their partnerships to call their union something less than marriage, which is what you would call it if it was a heterosexual couple.
So as someone who watches the Supreme Court, are you drawing any conclusions from that line of questioning today?
Well, we're in the business of warning people not to draw conclusions from oral argument. And I'll have to take my own advice. But I will say that there were things for both sides to latch onto. I think those who expected the oral argument to be a overwhelming success for the proponents of same-sex marriage and that the writing would be on the wall may have gotten less than they were hoping to get, because Justice Kennedy did seem to have real pause, and so did other justices, about making this kind of radical change in an institution. And it hasn't been very long since the court started on its path towards greater recognition for gay and lesbian couples, period. But Justice Kennedy has had this tangle between the equal dignity of persons and, you know, respect for tradition in the state in a couple of different cases, including the cases you mentioned at the beginning. And each time, the equal dignity of individuals seems to win out. And so there's also some reason to think that it's more likely than not that the court is going to end up striking down state bans on homosexual marriage. But But, you know, it's impossible to tell from oral argument is the short answer.
Now, you mentioned that the length of the oral argument was, you know, at one point you said 95 minutes. They were unusually long today, right? Why was that?
Well, that's right. Oral argument is usually an hour in each case. And the court was hearing two questions today, and so that would mean a potential total of 2 hours usually. But they extended the first question to 90 minutes in order to give time to the federal government, which was arguing for recognition of same-sex marriage. The Obama administration was, and I just to give, you know, the important issue a full hearing. And so the court ended up hearing, I think, a total of 2.5 hours of argument, and just a longer day and a longer first case than any of the justices typically are used to.
Taking a look at
this happens from time to time in the big cases.
And taking a look at the status of same-sex marriage here in the United States, how many states currently allow it?
Well, I think I'm going to try to get the numbers right, and hopefully I won't screw them up. But I think it's a total of 37 states that on one basis or another now permit same-sex marriage. What's interesting is that they break down in a few different ways. There are states that have voted for same-sex marriage. There are 11 of those. And Justice Scalia asked about that today in trying to emphasize the extent to which same-sex marriage is a product of democratic voting versus courts. There are 11 states that have voted for same-sex marriage. There's a number of other states, I'm not sure how many, I think it might be about 10, whose state courts have said that their state constitutions require equal treatment for same-sex couples. You can think of Iowa and Massachusetts as examples of those. And then there's a number of other states who have recently been required by federal courts. And those are the courts that the Supreme Court has jurisdiction over to review, required by federal courts under the federal constitution to honor same-sex marriage. So some of them are doing it freely and some of them not. And then there's a hybrid where some states have been ordered by a federal court to allow same-sex marriage, and then the governor says, okay, that sounds good, and they don't appeal, and they decide that they'd like to go along with the federal court ruling. So it's certainly become the majority position in the states very quickly in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision years ago.
And approval for same-sex marriage is at a record high, driven mostly by young people. Now the Supreme Court is its own entity, but is the court likely to be swayed by that at all?
You know, the justices are people, too, and they listen to public radio or they read the Washington Post or the Washington Times, according to their party, and they are definitely aware of both what's prevailing both among people generally, what popular opinion is, and also elite opinion, and there's no question they're definitely sensitive to a changing worldview on homosexual marriage and recognition and treatment of homosexual couples more generally. And so I would expect that to land on them. They nonetheless are interested in the law, and they mostly want to keep things governed by the Constitution and not public opinion polls. But being people of the real world, it can't fail to register with them.
Today was the first day of oral arguments. Do you have a sense, though, of the overarching timeline for a decision?
Well, it's already late in the Supreme Court's term, and the Supreme Court invariably, at least recently, finishes its work before the justices leave for the summer. And in cases like this one, which are both politically controversial, argued late in the year, and almost certain to result in dissenting opinions, so that multiple opinions have to be written, it's going to go to the last day or the second to last day in June. You know, a two-month turnaround is actually kind of short for many of the Supreme Court's opinions. And this will be one of the harder ones to write. So I would be very surprised if anything came out anything earlier than some of the last days of the term, which I believe are like June 25th, 6th, and 7th. So don't quote me on that one.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
That was attorney Eric Citrin. He's been covering today's oral arguments over same-sex marriage for SCOTUS Blog.